It is my pleasure and fortune to have the great honor and privilege to be with all of you today. And I would like to thank all of you for kindly taking your precious time to come to hear our humble discussion on the science of spirituality. As I was walking in on the entrance of this prestigious institution, I was appreciating the motto of the principles in which it was based upon. The search for knowledge, for the welfare and benefit of human society. And actually, this is what everyone should be striving for, whatever our occupation may be in life. Science is meant to improve the condition of life within the world. And for this purpose, throughout history, so many various forms of science have been pursued. There is the science of psychiatry, psychology, to understand deeper and deeper the nature of the mind, because mental problems cause so much suffering in this world. There is the science of biology, physics, chemistry, to analyze deeper and deeper the creation we are living in. And the more we understand, the more we could actually help to solve problems that people are facing. But at the same time, the deeper understanding we have of how this material nature works, the more we can actually cause the greatest, most terrible suffering within the world we live. And this is a fact. The pollutions, the destructions of the ecology, the bombs that are being created, the various gases that have been developed only to create suffering and destruction in warfare, they have been discovered and they have been developed by oftentimes men with very good and noble purposes, but they have been used by men who are plagued with envy and greed and a power, a thirst for power and manipulation over others. Within this chemical institution, every day you are discovering the wonderful, wonderful intricacies of the creation in which we live, more and more and more. And this is something sublime. But there is another science which is absolutely essential for the world to understand for the good of humanity. And that is the science of the essential background of this creation, the science of spirituality. This science is meant not only to discover and experience the very essence of our existence and the joy and glory of our true nature, but it is meant to share the wealth of real love with humanity. And when that wealth of love is established within a person's heart, then all the other various sciences will actually be utilized for the real welfare of human society. And without that, whatever we do, however good our intentions, it will not have the desired effect. The science of spirituality is truly a science like all other science. It is the original science. Every science we begin to study under authority. Just like I believe at this institution, you take seriously those people who have had proper education, who have studied under people who actually are authorized to train. You go to the colleges, the proper textbooks, the proper professors, and then your own realizations and the practical application of how to utilize that knowledge gradually expands more and more in your life. But today, when it comes to spirituality, people have become so drastically unscientific. Anything anyone wants to say is considered to be authority. When we talk about God, when we talk about the soul, here in India especially, more than anywhere else in the world, because I have traveled many places of the world, everyone has their opinions. Everyone has their interpretations. Everyone has their feelings. I believe God is this. I believe truth is this. Will anyone who comes to your institution and start giving their beliefs and their ideas be accepted? Or will you take seriously when they have been properly trained and studied under authority? So similarly, we must understand what is the truth beyond the perception of our senses from those scientific books and those professors who have deeply realized the context of those books. The physical sciences have been understood through theory, through experimentation, and through finding practical results. But when we talk about the source of life, when we talk about that stage of existence, which is beyond our sense perception, we must approach with faith. Sometimes in scientific circles, the idea of faith is looked down upon. But this, I must frankly say, is ridiculous. Because everybody has faith. 99.999% of what you believe, whether you are a scientist or whether you are a religionist, in your life is based on faith. Faith means to believe in something that is beyond the perception of your senses, something you have never seen or heard or tasted or touched. When I first came into Pune, we saw the nice statue of Mahatma Gandhi. How do we know that Mahatma Gandhi existed? There may be a few people still surviving who knew him personally. Other than that, it's based on faith. You never saw him. You never had direct experience. But you read about him in books. You've talked to people who may have seen him. I would be safe to say probably everyone in this room, your belief in the existence of Mahatma Gandhi is exclusively based on faith, beyond your own direct perception. Has anyone personally met him? So in this way, it is reasonable faith, because the people who have explained to him, the books that explain his history, are reasonable and they are trusted. Similarly, is this required? Can you hear? When we speak about geography, there are so many countries in the world. Most of us have not been to all those countries and all those continents. But because there are authorized maps, there are authorized geographical books, there are authorized people who have been to those places, we believe. That is called faith. In fact, who is your mother is exclusively based on faith. You were not there. At least you were there, but you were not able to perceive. Who was your mother and father at the time of conception? And when you're a baby, you don't know what is what. But gradually, as you're growing, you accept that this is my mother and this is my father. So anyone who casts this ridiculous, most foolish assumption that we do not accept things on the basis of faith is completely contradicting practically everything he accepts in life as true. But there is a difference between reasonable faith, faith based on reason, logic, philosophy, common sense, faith which is consistent with our perceptions in this world, that is reasonable faith. Faith in authority that know, that have experience. And when we try to approach that science of what is beyond the capacity of our mind and senses to conceive, we have to accept it on the basis of faith. But it is the position of our good mind and intelligence to rationally be convinced that what is being spoken, that what is being understood, is reasonable. The existence of God. No one throughout history has ever disproved the existence of God. There has been so many theories, there has been so many hypotheses, there has been so many claims that there is no God. But has anyone ever been there at the beginning of the creation of this universe to see with their own eyes whether God did it or whether it happened by chance? All of our scientific studies, which negate the idea of God, is simply speculation. No evidence. At the most, putting a few ideas together and coming up with what they call truth. But this is not evidence. The question that is often asked, is everything coming from something, or is everything coming from nothing? Now, the atheists believe that everything is coming from nothing. And the devotees of God believe that everything is coming from something. Now, which is more reasonable?
According to our perception in this world, have we ever found anything that has come from nothing? Everything has a cause. What is your cause? You have a mother and a father. And what was their cause? Your grandmother and grandfather. And their cause, your great-grandmother and your great-grandfather. Whenever you see a tree, you know as a fact that that came from a seed that has come from another tree, which came from a seed that came from another tree. And this microphone that we are speaking in, made of metals and rubbers and wires and various conductors, they are all coming from various ingredients of the earth. Everything that we have ever experienced in our entire life has come from something, has come from a cause. So consistent with logic, is it reasonable to accept that everything comes from something? And that is the definition of God according to the Vedas. Janmadyashayataha. The Vedanta Sutra declares, God is the absolute truth, is that from whom everything emanates. Is ultimately there is a cause for all causes, or is there no cause for all causes? So it is obviously the scientific assumption in this case to accept that everything is coming from something, that there is a cause, or there is God, an absolute truth. Now, to understand this truth, according to the great authorities of the scriptures which have been existing since time immemorial, and according to those great spiritual professors who have lived since time immemorial, they are explaining that that absolute truth reveals who he is, how things are working in this world under his control. And that is what the scriptures are. They are the science books revealed by God himself. Just like if you buy a sophisticated piece of machinery, such as a computer, the manufacturer will also give you a manual of how to operate it so you get the best results from it. In the same way, the scriptures are the revealed instruction manual of how to live within this world and get the best results within your life. Throughout history, let us examine the most noble, compassionate, loving, influential people. In every society, in every country, in every age, practically all of them were people who deeply studied and realized this spiritual science. And they were telling us not just what they believe, but what they see. Science means hypothesis, some theory, some process of experimentation, and then direct observation of the result. Spirituality is the greatest science. And you will not know until you make a test of this science. First, to understand what are the truths revealed by Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Then, to actually apply the process that is given to our life. And anyone who has done this sincerely, under proper authority, actually experiences, observes, what are the sublime truths beyond our mind and senses. I would like to explain very briefly In summary, what are the truths that the Bhagavad Gita and other great scriptures declare? The first truth is to understand, who am I? What is the source of life within me? Krishna in Gita describes, Dehinosmin yatha dehe, komaram yogaram chara, tatha dehantara praptir, dhirasthatra namu yate. That there are eight material elements, bhumir aponalo vayu, kamano buddha eva cha, and earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Basic elements. Those elements can be broken down into innumerable categories. Deeper and deeper, deeper study. And basically, that is what much of your work is doing here in this university, or in this, I'm sorry, this institution. Breaking down into deeper and deeper investigations how material nature is working. And subtler than all the chemicals that we can see is the mind, the intelligence, and the ego. You cannot see the mind. You cannot touch it. A thought is physically totally intangible. But it exists. It exists so much we can't get away from them. Sometimes we are plagued with our thoughts. Sometimes so much anxiety due to thoughts coming in, coming in, coming in. Actually, if you have to pay your bills and you don't have any money, the physical situation is not so bad. But the anxiety in your mind is unbearable. It can plague your whole life. When someone physically dies that you love, that physically, what's happened is some chemicals have readjusted itself and now the body is dead. But what does it do to our mind? It devastates us. We weep, we cry, sometimes we become immobilized. This is all thoughts. Can you observe a thought under a microscope? There may be certain waves that machines have to basically show certain patterns in the brain, but to grasp and analyze that thought is beyond our physical perception. But Krishna explains in Gita, apareyamitasvanyam prakritim virime param jiva bhuta mahabaho yajedam dharyate jagat. Beyond this gross and subtle matter is a spiritual force which is the source of consciousness wherever there is life. And that source of consciousness is called the Atma, or the soul, the spirit soul. And it is explained that this body is like a chariot. Today we don't ride in chariots. Today we ride in automobiles. So when you go in an automobile, the automobile is meant to take you someplace. It has its functions. But you are not the automobile. You are the person who is consciously making the automobile animate. The automobile cannot turn on itself. Even the most sophisticated computer systems cannot operate without a person, a living being, turning it on. Matter is essentially dead, and this body is essentially dead unless there is a person within it, a conscious force within it. And Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, what is the nature of this conscious force? Na jayate mriyate va kadachin nayan bhuta bhavita bhavanubhuya. This conscious force is eternal. It is not born and it does not die. Mamayavamso jivaloke jivabhutashanata. Its nature is that it is eternal, full of knowledge, and full of bliss. It is part and parcel of the Supreme Conscious Force, the Paramatma. And when this conscious force forgets its own nature, its own blissful nature, its own godly nature, it becomes entrapped in ignorance or illusion. And what is that ignorance or illusion? When that conscious force within us simply identifies with the designations born of matter. And this is the source of all the problems and sufferings in the world. If you read the papers or travel, you will find what's happening. The newspapers very seldom give any good news. It's mostly crises, tragedies, dangers, miseries. Very well. Why? Because we are ignorant of our real, eternal, blissful nature. Indians and Pakistanis are fighting over whose land is whose, but actually the soul is neither Indian nor is it Pakistani. There is so much strife amongst the castes. The lower castes want more rights and powers. The higher castes want to push them down and maintain control and dignity in their own conception. But actually, the soul has nothing to do with any caste. Men and women are always in conflict. It is an age-old problem. In the West, there's a great war between the males and the females. But actually, the soul is neither male nor female in the physical sense. There is always conflict between generations. When I went to college in the 1960s in America, there was a war, literally declared war, being fought between the young generation and the older generation. And in any university, it was the motto, it was the war cry of all the youth. Anyone over 30, never trust them. And we live by that. So this is the condition. And this is supposed to be the most highly educated, qualified, sophisticated, technological, scientific country in the world, the United States of America. And the blacks and the whites have been fighting. They have been enslaved. And to this day, in the streets, there's always wars between black people and white people. But the soul is either neither old nor young, nor black nor white. Building bombs over the misconception of different nationalities. But the soul has no nationality. And all the technology and science and all the so-called improvements that we are making through our scientific discoveries are practically being utilized by people who have these ignorant misconceptions. Einstein, Oppenheimer, they were actually deeply religious men in their own ways with high moral standards. And they investigated very, very, very deeply how this material works and what type of power is within the atom, what type of power is within God's creation. And according to their conception, the more they discover that power, the more that power will be used for the benefit of humanity. But their investigations and their studies and their discoveries came into the wrong hands, and they simply used it for the purpose of destruction, of power. And these poor men, geniuses in their own right, they realized that they had created something that could destroy the world. Not created, discovered. And it plagued their consciousness. And because they were men of God in their own rights, and they had dignity and integrity, they regretted for the rest of their lives what they had done. What we discover in our scientific laboratories, is it going to be for the good of humanity, or is it just going to be used by greedy people for commercial purposes to exploit people for their own sense enjoyment, for their own power? It is a great danger. It is the greatest danger. And we should not be a part of this danger. We should be a part of the solution. And the solution is to understand what is the true godly quality of our existence, and to try to give that knowledge and understanding to others. Then every aspect of life can be utilized for the right purpose and the real good of men and women, of all living beings. So Krishna and all the great acharyas and teachers of all the great genuine scriptures of the world and all the enlightened souls have told us this principle, that we are that eternal soul. We are blissful by nature. We are kind and loving, unselfish, without false ego. And real happiness means to cleanse our mind and our heart from the misconceptions of the ignorance that we are now bound to. That comes through spiritual practice. The soul within this life is identical to the soul that is in all forms of life. But in the lower species of life, the souls are simply engrossed in the bodily and mental conceptions and are simply trying to survive through the process of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And the soul evolves through the various species of life from lower to higher. That is what takes place at the time of death, until the soul comes to its most fortunate and auspicious condition. It enters into the human species of life. Human being is called the rational animal. What does that mean? Within human life, we have the rational power to make choices. The animals make no choices. They act according to their instinct. They have no power to decide to do something else. We have never seen a cow attacking a deer and eating it. The cow will eat the grass and it will always eat the grass. You'll never find a tiger eating grass. You'll never find a dog taking a vow of celibacy for higher realizations in life. Why? Because every animal just acts according to its nature. But a human being can decide to be and do anything. That is rational. Human life, according to the Vedanta Sutra, is meant to understand and realize our spiritual essence, atato brahma jigyasa. And a human being that does not use that developed consciousness for realizing spiritual knowledge is actually no better than an animal in quality. Our Guru Maharaj used to say that a dog is running on four legs and you are running on four wheels. What is the difference? You are running from one place to another just to satisfy your mind and senses. the same quality of consciousness. You are using your sophisticated, God-given human intelligence simply to pursue the same purposes of the lower species. But when we utilize this intelligence to understand who we are, what is the purpose of life, what is real happiness, what is real good to humanity, that's when our human existence is actually fulfilled. In this human life, we are born, we grow, we have some endurance for some time. Gradually, we start to grow old and deteriorate. We may produce some offspring in the process, and then we die. What happens at death? There are so many speculations, but has anyone actually discovered what happens at death? Some people say at the time of death, the chemicals are changed, the life is gone, you as we know you cease to exist. But Krishna explains in the Gita, and it can also be rationally understood by our own common sense, that from the time of our birth, our body and mind are going through so many transformations and changes, but we remain the same. The same person, observing through various conditions of our body and mind. So at the time of death, it is like when the car is no longer usable. You go from one car and you enter into another car or automobile. According to the consciousness and the quality of our desires, the soul is implicated in the laws of karma or the laws of action and reaction. For every action, there is an equal corresponding reaction. That is a law of nature. There is the law of gravity. What goes up must come down. There are laws in this world. But there are also laws that you cannot see. You can see the results of it, but you may not see exactly how it's happening. Why some people are born into suffering conditions? Why some people are born into prosperous conditions? Why people look different and think different? This is all creations that have been born of the consciousness that we have had in previous lives. The soul takes shelter of a particular form accordingly. Now, when we come to the point of practically applying spiritual principles to our life, we gradually cleanse our minds of all artificial, superficial, illusory designations. And we gradually have direct perception and realization of our eternal soul and its true glory and its true nature. And that is called self-realization. And all those great souls who have taken to this process have come to the same conclusion, have seen, not with these eyes, but with the very eyes of the soul, and experienced an eternal stratum of existence, which is the background and underlying essence of all creation. And what is that process? The process is to live in harmony with the laws of nature and the laws of the manufacturer of nature, or the laws of the Supreme. That means to live a pious and moral life, not to do harm to others, not to unnecessarily ignite and aggravate our propensities for greed and false prestige. And these are the basic principles that every society is based on, because every society originally was based on religious spiritual principles. No illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling, no animal slaughter. These are the basic principles of human civilization and compassion. To keep the company of people who are pious, who are moral, and who are genuinely seeking spiritual principles. To study under those professors who are properly authorized to teach by their realizations and by what they have learned from the past, from the scriptures, from the sadhus, what actually is the path of perfection. And in this age of Kali Yuga, there is a wonderful, wonderful process, a most sublime and scientific process of bringing about an awakening of the original spiritual, ecstatic, loving consciousness within us. And that is the chanting of the transcendental sound vibration of the name of God. We are called the Hare Krishna movement because we chant Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This is called mantra. Man means mind, and tra means to free, to liberate, to deliver. Mantra means that sound vibration which liberates the mind from all the anxieties born of illusion in this world. It is a spiritual sound. This sound vibration actually has the power to cleanse and to free our soul, our consciousness, from misconception. Just like today, there is such a problem with water, especially here in India. Any foreigner that comes to India, the first thing that they're told to do is do not drink the ordinary water, because there's so many pollutants. Sometimes they're chemical pollutants, sometimes they're bacterial pollutants, but there's so many pollutants. But when you properly filter water, what you are doing is bringing the water back to its original natural state. So our consciousness, the soul, is originally pure. It is full of joy. It is full of love. But now the soul has been contaminated, polluted, by so many misconceptions, by so many superficial temporary designations. When we chant this mantra, when we take to real spiritual principles, gradually what happens is our consciousness is filtered, it is purified, it is cleansed, it is brought back to its original natural state of God consciousness, Krishna consciousness. And this is self-realization. And when we have this, then we have the real position by which we can do the greatest good for humanity. Science, material science, is a wonderful thing. It is one of the most wonderful things if it is utilized by people who have God-conscious realizations. People who use it in pursuance of truth. People who use it with compassion and with love and with a real, genuine understanding of the needs of society. Otherwise, all various forms of science and occupational duties have no real substance to doing any real good for man. You can feed a poor man, and that's good. You can heal a sick man, and that's good. But still, they will be hungry and die in due course of time. But if we learn that science of giving people direct perception of their eternal, spiritual, joyful nature, beyond birth and beyond death, and at the same time utilize the physical sciences to make this world a better place for everyone to pursue the ultimate purpose, then we have done something wonderful. So it is the dignity of every human being to choose what is the most auspicious and important purpose of life. And that is something that each and every one of us should very carefully contemplate. Our spiritual master, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, spread this message of the teaching of the Vedas throughout the world, developed environment as far as material opulence, as far as modern enmities. They were frustrated. Having money will never make you happy. Having good cars and good televisions and good computers and good telephone system and good hospitals will not make you happy. We had it all. Modern hospitals, modern telephone exchange, best possible computers and everything else in every home. But our hearts were empty. And we looked around and we just saw everybody like a rat race. You have seen rats when they're on the wheel. They're running and running and running and running and running. And they think they're going so far, but they're getting nowhere. If you just take an objective look at society, they are running so madly in so many different ways, trying to go forward. And they think they're going forward, but it's like that wheel that the rat is racing. It's getting nowhere. We have developed science so wonderfully in so many years. Look at what we have. 100 years ago, here in India, people were sitting under trees talking. They didn't have microphones. They didn't have auditoriums. They didn't have all of these wonderful automobiles and everything else. But still, the same anxieties, the same frustrations were there and then, and they're even more now. We have the best hospitals, but still people are being sick and dying. Have we actually improved? No, we have not improved. We may say, but we're curing so many diseases. But because we're not curing the disease that makes us commit activities which we're accountable by the laws of material nature, you can cure one disease, another disease will come. We have cured smallpox. That's wonderful. But because we're still engaging in the same unclean types of activities, AIDS has come, and more people are dying of AIDS than smallpox. Have we advanced? Until we advance by changing the quality of our life and our consciousness, there's no real advancement at all. So this is the most important thing for a human being to contemplate. What is the quality of my life? What will I really do for humanity during my life? And at the time of death, what will be the destination of my soul? This is the highest, most most critical science in all of creation. And our very humble request is, let us utilize the wonderful talents and the wonderful discoveries that we have in the most compassionate and the most realistic way to do real good to humanity. And then that wonderful, principle that I so pleasingly saw on the gateway of your institution will actually find its real fulfillment. Thank you very much. Is any questions that anyone may want to ask? Speak loudly, please.
How do you define spirituality? And how can you distinguish scientists with spiritual mind and low spiritual mind?
The question is how to define spirituality and how to distinguish a scientist who has a spiritual mind or does not have a spiritual mind. A scientist who genuinely has a real spiritual mind is one who has properly studied spiritual science from a proper spiritual teacher. And is applying his scientific occupation according to that direction. This holds true with a politician, a businessman, a housewife, or a student, whatever occupation. If we are living our life and performing our duty under spiritual direction, the direction of the scriptures, the direction of the teacher who is presenting the essence and the truth of the scriptures, then we can understand that we are actually that person is performing his scientific work in a genuine spiritual direction. And spirituality means pursuing the spiritual nature within us through all of our aspects of life. Through our family, to learn to live within our family, to live within our occupation, to live within our society. Everything should be oriented in such a way that we are living in harmony and in pursuance of the spiritual truths within us and which underlie this entire creation. Does that answer your question? Is there any other questions? Yes. How is spirituality different from religious practices? In a common sense, today, most religion is not based on scientific, philosophical truth. Most religion is based on superstition and sentimentalism. And most religious teachers are just giving their own opinions and their own ideas. And many of them are doing it for the purpose of becoming famous, of becoming worshipable. It is their occupation. Just like our Guru Maharaj said when he was a little boy living in Calcutta, he would sometimes see this one man. He had a wife and children, and he was actually making a lot of money. And every morning, Srila Prabhupada would see this man, he would put on his business clothes, which happened to be saffron robes. And he would put on tilak. And then he would go door to door begging as a sadhu. and giving people blessings. And then all the money he'd make, he'd bring home, and he'd buy nice, every type of thing for his family to enjoy. So that was the way he made his living. So these types of spiritual teachers, which there are so many, giving their own concocted ideas, exploiting people, they in many ways are ruining the name of religion amongst intelligent, scientific-minded people. And so many of our mothers and fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers and so people, they perform pujas. They don't even know why they're doing it. It's simply out of fear that if I don't do it, something bad may happen to me. Today, most religion is not based on truth. It is based on superstition. It's based on sentiment. It's based on exploitation, concoction. So if that's what we consider to be religion, that is not real religion. Real religion is spirituality. Real religion is based on the authority of God and the chain of disciplic succession of great professors or teachers who have preserved the original teachings of the truth. Real religion and real spirituality is based on truly pursuing the genuine spiritual principles underlying this creation and how to live in harmony with them. And this is a great science. It is the most important of all sciences. In the Western world, and even in India, we are meeting so many young college students in India, and they are turning away from their own spiritual heritage because they do not see a philosophical, logical, scientific basis to it. And they have so much Western education that they can't just accept things blindly. But as soon as they hear the same thing that their parents are teaching, that their parents are doing, but when they hear it, according to the real teachings, they accept. And they live by it, greater than any of their ancestors, because they have actual scientific, philosophical conviction of what is to be done. That is the difference between real spirituality and common religion. A real spiritual leader is explained within the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, within the Bible and Quran, it says the same thing. This is the authority by which we can discriminate. A real spiritual leader is simply one who presents the spiritual truths as they are revealed in the scriptures. He does not give his own opinions. That's a real professor too, is it not? A real spiritual leader is one who lives by these principles. Someone who is not acting out of greed, someone who lives a very simple life, who is selfless and genuinely trying to always help others, physically, mentally, spiritually. A person who is compassionate, tolerant, self-satisfied, and a person who is always speaking the glorification of spiritual truths and helping others to advance to those principles. That is a real spiritual leader. He can be wearing a suit or tie. She could be wearing a sari. Could be wearing robes also. A spiritual leader is not a matter of dress or hairstyle. A spiritual leader is one who manifests these qualities within one's life. Yes. Has spirituality what? Induce devotion? Yes. As we develop our spiritual lives, as we become purified, deeper and deeper is devotion manifested in our life. Because it is the quality of the very essence of our existence, our soul, to have devotion, bhakti, devotion to God and devotion to all of God's manifestations. And this is the greatest of all virtues, devotion. In fact, it is only through devotion that we can come to true realization of God. And simultaneously, as we come to deeper realizations of God, our devotion becomes more and more intensified, pure. And it is this devotion toward the will of God and toward the betterment of mankind that is the real hope for the world. Is there any other questions?